content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week, we're reading from the edition dated July 15th, 2011. Our first article for this week is entitled, Obama, GOP, and a Debt Ceiling Standoff. With a government default looming, President Obama summoned Republican congressional leaders to the White House this week for face-to-face negotiations over raising the federal debt ceiling. Democrats and Republicans had reached an impasse over what conditions should be attached to raising the government's $14.3 trillion debt ceiling, which will be reached on August 2nd. The Democrats have agreed to a $2 trillion package of spending cuts over the next decade, but also want to raise about $400 billion in revenue by eliminating tax breaks and deductions that benefit oil companies, owners of corporate jets, and those in the highest tax bracket. I think it's only fair to ask an oil company or a corporate jet owner that has done so well to give up a tax break that no other business enjoys, said the president. But GOP leaders remained adamant that they would not agree to tax increases of any kind. The American people don't want their taxes raised, and they wanted us to cut spending, said John McCain, a Republican from Arizona. They don't want compromise. The White House has warned that Congress must reach a consensus by July 22nd to give it time to issue new debt bonds. If the U.S. were to default on its debt obligations, many economists warn, Uncle Sam's credibility would be ruined. The value of the dollar would likely plummet, and interest rates would surge, possibly leading to another deep recession. But Obama expressed optimism that he could broker a deal. It's my hope that everyone is going to leave their ultimatums at the door, Obama said. Here's what the editorials had to say. It's easy to see why the Republicans are playing hardball, said The Economist. Conservative voters are implacably opposed to raising the debt ceiling on the mistaken belief that doing so opens the door to future profligacy instead of paying debts already incurred. Still, legislators will be viewed as traitors if they agree to tax increases. It still makes sense for Republicans to hold out to the last minute and extract the best deal possible. The game of chicken has gone far enough, said the Los Angeles Times. The Republicans are right to insist that the government end its spending binge, but while federal spending makes up roughly 25% of gross domestic product, revenues constitute just 14%, a 70-year low. Clearly, spending cuts alone can't erase annual deficits now surpassing $1 trillion. The time for ideological posturing is over. Cut a deal. Now here's what the columnist said. The Republican Party doesn't want a deal, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com. Its leaders want the government to slide into default and catastrophe to result because they know that a lousy economy is their only shot at gaining power. That's why the president ought to invoke the 14th Amendment, said Katrina Vandal Hoeville in the Washington Post, which says that the validity of the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned. Obama can argue that the clause gives him the right to order the Treasury to continue paying America's bills, even if Congress fails to authorize it. It may be the only way to defuse the bomb Republicans have strapped to the hostage. It's overburdened taxpayers and underemployed workers who are being held hostage, says James Pethakoukas in Reuters.com. The U.S. economy is sputtering with a measly 1.9% growth rate. Raising taxes on investors and businesses would certainly push us back into recession, while faster economic growth would lead to higher tax revenues. The GOP should stick to its guns. The Republicans have already won this debate, said David Brooks in the New York Times. Democrats have offered them the deal of the century, trillions in spending cuts, in exchange for closing some distortionary tax loopholes, affecting a tiny percentage of the population. But the extremists who hijack the GOP would prefer to let the nation default rather than give an inch on their sacred fixation on taxes. The GOP must decide what party it wants to be, a responsible conservative party or an odd protest movement of unyielding fanatics that is unfit to govern. The next item, Casey Anthony acquitted. In a verdict that shocked millions of Americans who had followed the case for more than a year, unmarried mother Casey Anthony was acquitted of murdering her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee, so she could be free to live as a single woman. The prosecution presented a strong circumstantial case, including the 25-year-old Anthony's failure to report her daughter missing for more than a month while she went clubbing and got a tattoo that said "The Good Life" in Italian. There were indications that Anthony had researched how to make chloroform, and prosecutors argued that duct tape found over the nose and mouth of Kaylee's decomposed body was incontrovertible evidence of murder. But the defense posited an alternative scenario, saying the toddler drowned in a pool and a panicked Casey enlisted her father's help to dispose of the body. Juror Jennifer Ford said she and other jurors cried and were sick to their stomachs over acquitting Anthony, but felt there was not enough evidence to convict her. "This verdict was far more shocking than the acquittal of O.J. Simpson," said former Simpson prosecutor Marcia Clark in the DailyBeast.com. "None of the defense's proffered reasons to doubt Anthony's guilt were remotely reasonable, but that distinction can get lost in the jury room. As a result, a 25-year-old sociopath now walks free," said Andrea Pizer in the New York Post. "Casey Anthony was convicted only of lying to police, one would assume, about killing her daughter, and could be released immediately since she's already spent 3 years in jail. She never shed a tear for her dead baby. As cable TV's Nancy Gray said, somewhere out there tonight, the devil is dancing." Grace and her cable cohorts are guilty of massive overkill, said Howard Kurtz in the DailyBeast.com. Kaylee's murder wouldn't have been covered at all if Anthony hadn't been white, middle class, and attractive. The media circus has exploited this tragedy until it becomes entertainment. And that explains the nation's outrage, said Alexandra Petri in the Washington Post. An American public raised on Law and Order episodes can't accept that after months of hearing Nancy Grace denounce Anthony as a callous, evil murderer, we were cheated out of our guilty verdict. Justice, injustice, it's a show, and we didn't like the ending. The DSK case is falling apart. With their case collapsing, prosecutors met with Dominique Strauss-Kahn's legal team this week in an attempt to work out a plea bargain to settle sexual assault charges against him. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office sought the meeting after releasing Strauss-Kahn and house arrest and disclosing that the hotel maid who'd accused him of sexual assault had a substantial credibility issue. The maid, an immigrant from Guinea, admitted to lying about being gang-raped in her home country on her asylum application and was taped telling a drug dealer on a prison telephone that it was worth pursuing legal charges against Strauss-Kahn because he had a lot of money. The woman's lawyer said she had made some mistakes. That doesn't mean she isn't a rape victim. Her testimony, he said, was supported by forensic evidence that included semen on her maid's uniform and vaginal bruising. In France this week, novelist Tristane Bannon, 32, filed charges accusing Strauss-Kahn of attempting to rape her in 2003. His lawyers labeled Bannon's claims imaginary and said they would sue for slander. "So the maid is a shady character," said Joanna Molloy in the New York Daily News. "It doesn't mean that the horny Frenchman is innocent. If this case collapses, it will send a message to rape victims that pressing charges is futile. Au contraire, this stunning reversal of fortune shows our legal system's strength," said Joe Nasera in the New York Times. "Prosecutors trusted a hotel maid who made a credible accusation against a man with enormous power, and when her credibility crumbled, they admitted the case's flaws. In France, where commentators are proud that elites are rarely held to account, such equality before the law doesn't exist. I am glad that I live here." Yes, the system worked, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post, but only after Strauss-Kahn lost his IMF post and, most likely, his chance to run in next year's French presidential election. Prosecutors should have done their homework before ruining DSK's reputation. As the French say, c'est une catastrophe. The controversy of the week this week is entitled The Declaration of Independence. What does freedom mean? Unhappy a birthday, America, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post, in this summer of our discontent. As partisans battle over budget deficits and the debt ceiling, Americans celebrated the 235th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence last week, bitterly divided over what kind of government the founders had envisioned. For many conservatives, it has become an article of faith that the founders were declaring not only America's independence from Britain, but the freedom of individual citizens to live as they choose without interference or enfeebling assistance from the government. The Tea Party has taken this view to a radical new purity, clamoring for eliminating or ruthlessly cutting 50-year-old social programs that are woven into America's fabric. Liberals, meanwhile, are insisting that the founders rejected the callous aloofness of Britain rule precisely because they did want a government committed to mutual welfare and social justice. In their own self-indulgent fantasies, liberals think the extravagant spending, now busting the budget, can be financed simply by cutting defense or increasing taxes on the rich. What's to debate, said Mark Stein in Investor's Business Daily. The founding fathers could have severed ties with Britain in a single sentence if they wanted to. Instead, in the middle of a shooting war, they worked for days crafting a stirring testament to the Republican virtues of a self-reliant citizenry, free to exploit its own potential. The Declaration is a song of human liberation, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post, promising Americans the pursuit of happiness. Too many Americans today are not pursuing happiness. They are demanding it in the form of government assistance paid for with other people's tax dollars. Anyone who objects to this perversion of our founders' vision gets scolded for lacking compassion. The founders were anything but anti-government zealots, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. Indeed, the Declaration states that their primary grievance against the British Crown was the King's failure to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance to the public good. The Declaration thus defines government's central function as ensuring the general welfare of citizens, the public good. We rebel to create a more caring government, not a smaller one. Note also that the founders objected not to taxes, but to taxation without representation. For modern conservatives to use the Declaration to justify their refusal to ask the rich to pay slightly more in taxes, even if it means defaulting on our national debt or letting poor people go hungry, is, well, crazy. The truth, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial, is that the Declaration was a pragmatic compromise between a group of rich white men with profoundly differing opinions about governance, with some bitterly opposed to a strong central government and others insisting that only a unifying federal system could keep the nation from disintegrating into chaos. To try to use the beliefs of any one founder or faction to justify a modern political stance is a pointless exercise. Perhaps we can agree on one thing, said Newsday. Our founding document's most revolutionary statement is that all men are created equal, with an inherent right to be free. Over the centuries, that single powerful idea took on a life of its own, not only in America but around the world, and continues to inspire people to throw off oppression. After 235 years, even as Americans argue over the definition of freedom itself, the Declaration's breakthrough premise is aging wonderfully well. And now from the Week magazine for this week, let's turn to the section entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4, always an entertaining section. It was a good week for a really close shave after an Oregon company began selling a razor for $100,000. The Zafiro Iridium features solid white sapphire blades that are sharpened to 5,000 times thinner than the width of a hair and will supposedly last forever. It was a good week for police dogs after German police scrapped an experiment to locate bodies with trained vultures instead of sniffer dogs. "Everyone knows what vultures do when they find a body," explained one official. "You could find half the evidence disappearing down their beaks." And it was a good week for Joey Jaws Chestnut after the competitive eater won the annual Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest at New York's Coney Island by wolfing down 62 hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes. Now, at the same time, and this doesn't happen too often, but it was a bad week for Joey Jaws Chestnut, whose binge loaded up his digestive and cardiovascular systems with 19,158 calories, 1,246 grams of fat, 2,170 grams of cholesterol, and 42,408 milligrams of sodium. And that was, in case you've forgotten the first one, 62 hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes. It was a bad week for Ian Cole of Michigan after a tour boat left him behind as he snorkeled in the shark-infested waters of Australia's Great Barrier Reef. "I lifted my head to get my bearings, and there is no boat," Cole said, admitting he panicked. Another boat picked him up right away. And it was a bad week for sneaky dog owners after a New Hampshire apartment complex required dog owners to submit a DNA sample from their pets so that any unscooped poop can be traced. "Some owners are calling the policy ridiculous," said the complex's manager, "and I'm sure that those are the people who are doing it." And now let's turn to the People section of the Week magazine. And this week our first item is entitled Sugar Ray Leonard's Toughest Fight. "Sugar Ray Leonard is relieved that his secret is out," said Gordon Marino in the Wall Street Journal. At 55, the former boxing champion has recently revealed that he was sexually abused as a teenager twice. The first time, he says, it was by a well-known Olympic boxing coach who began touching him and making sexual suggestions. He describes the man involved in the second incident only as a white man in a position of authority. "He helped me here and there with cash that I really needed. He put his hands in a sexual way on my shoulders and began moving down. I couldn't believe it was happening again. I ran out to my car where I started shaking and crying." He kept the incidents to himself for years, though even after he became a champion, he would sometimes burst into tears for no apparent reason. "No one asked why I was crying. No one asked, 'How are you feeling, Ray?'" he says with evident bitterness. The abuse fueled his rage in the ring, and it also took him to some dark places with drugs and drinking, and to the end of his first marriage. He sobered up, began therapy, and found that confronting his demons was worth it. "Other guys have come up to me and told me that it happened to them, too. They often have a tear in their eye. I tell them that it's all right." Harry Potter star Daniel Radcliffe revealed this week that he has been struggling with alcohol dependency for several years. The actor, who is now 21 years old, told GQ that he began drinking whiskey on the set of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince when he was 18, and that he had to give up drinking altogether because it was taking over his life. "I became so reliant on alcohol to enjoy stuff," said Radcliffe. "There were a few years there when I was just so enamored with the idea of living some sort of famous person's lifestyle that really isn't suited to me." And finally, from the People section, a guilt-ridden Arnold Schwarzenegger knows he must pay a steep price for his infidelities. His soon-to-be ex, Maria Shriver, filed for divorce last week, and sources told RadarOnline.com that Schwarzenegger will offer a very generous settlement, with more than half of his estimated net worth of $500 to $750 million. "Arnold realizes he is to blame for the collapse of his marriage," said the source. "Maria was a loving wife and mother, and he doesn't think that any amount of money can minimize what he has put her through." And you're listening to our reading of The Week magazine for July 15th, 2011. Now we're going to turn to the section entitled The Briefing. It's a weekly feature. And this specific article is The Man Who Killed Tax Increases. Anti-tax activist Grover Norquist holds no office but wields enormous power in Washington. What are his goals? Who is Grover Norquist in the first place? Well, he's a conservative activist best known as the head of Americans for Tax Reform, a taxpayer advocacy group that is opposed to any and all tax increases. A fierce partisan who once referred to bipartisanship as date rape, Norquist argues that taxation is inherently oppressive and that big government is a burden on the American people. The government's power to control one's life derives from its power to tax, he says in the organization's mission statement. We believe that power should be minimized. He's called for abolishing such agencies as the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Education, and the National Endowment for the Arts. He famously once said that he hoped to shrink government until he could drown it in a bathtub. Democrats like journalist Arianna Huffington view Norquist as the dark wizard of the right's anti-tax cult. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich calls him the single most effective conservative activist in the country. What makes him effective? His single-minded focus on one goal, to make it impossible for politicians to raise taxes for any reason, including to balance budgets. In 1985, the Reagan administration set up Americans for Tax Reform to lobby in favor of overhauling the tax code. Reagan installed the 29-year-old Norquist, who'd served as economist at the Chamber of Commerce, as its chairman. To ensure that future Congresses would not reverse Reagan-era tax cuts, Norquist wrote the Taxpayer Protection Pledge, an oath made by lawmakers directly to their constituents never to support tax increases of any kind. More than 1,200 federal, state, and local Republican officeholders have signed the oath, which has become a litmus test for true conservative values. Those who violate it often face primary challenges from candidates Norquist endorses. Well, how powerful is that pledge? It's had enormous influence in the current Congress. 235 congressmen and 41 senators have signed the pledge. Only 7 Republican congressmen and 7 senators have not. Thanks largely to Norquist's efforts, tax increases have become political suicide, and Americans now pay the lowest percentage of their incomes in federal taxes since 1958. Republicans, in fact, are refusing even to consider any tax increases in their current battle with Democrats over the debt ceiling. Norquist says Republicans learned a valuable lesson when George H.W. Bush broke the pledge and raised taxes to plug a budget deficit in 1990, and then lost to Bill Clinton. He gets thrown out of the office by a bum, a nobody from Arkansas, Norquist says. The message was, you can't break the pledge. How did Norquist develop his philosophy? Well, Norquist grew up in a well-to-do family in Weston, Massachusetts, the son of a Polaroid executive. He remembers gravitating to conservative views as far back as the 6th grade, and at 12, he volunteered for Richard Nixon's 1968 presidential campaign. An excellent student, he later graduated from Harvard University and Harvard Business School, where he delighted in challenging the liberal status quo. I've been a winger from way back, Norquist says. I was an anti-communist first, then I became an economic conservative. I think I've often more radical, I've gotten more radical as I've gotten older. Bearded and bespeckled, the 54-year-old Norquist today has an owlish professorial manner and is considered something of a raconteur in Beltway circles. How has he used his influence? Name a landmark Republican policy of the past 20 years, and chances are that Norquist was involved. He helped Gingrich author the Contract with America in 1994, convinced wary movement conservatives to support George W. Bush's run for president in 2000, and played a major part in crafting the Bush tax cuts in 2001. Norquist has also sought to bring together different conservative factions at a weekly Washington meeting of what he calls the Leave Us Alone Coalition. The meeting, held every Wednesday, brings together policymakers, lobbyists, and activists for influential discussions about the future direction of the Republican Party. Do all conservatives like him? No, some see him as something of an unreasonable tyrant on tax issues. He recently feuded with Senator Tom Coburn, a Republican from Oklahoma, and several other Republican senators because they had voted to eliminate $6 billion in ethanol subsidies to farmers. Norquist insists that removing existing tax breaks violates the pledge. Social conservatives view Norquist with distrust because he's primarily a libertarian and sits on the board of Go Proud, a conservative gay rights group. Neocons were offended because Norquist spoke out against the Iraq War as a waste of money in 2004 and because he founded the Islamic Free Market Institute to foster business links with the Muslim world. Since he's married to a Palestinian Muslim, Sama Al-Rais, some neocons have even questioned whether he is an agent of influence for Islamists in Washington. Norquist dismisses these criticisms as a distraction from the real battle, which is to keep cutting taxes and shrinking government. My ideal citizen is the self-employed, homeschooling, IRA, individual retirement account, owning guy with a concealed carry to carry permit, he says, because that person doesn't need the damn government for anything. And the carve-out section from this briefing is entitled The Reaganites Reaganite. Ronald Reagan has become a near-sacred figure to most modern Republicans, but Norquist puts even the party's most ardent Reaganites to shame. Norquist cut his teeth as one of Reagan's anti-communist activists in the mid-1980s, traveling with Colonel Oliver North to spread the Reagan Doctrine to places like Nicaragua, Afghanistan, Mozambique, and Angola. It was Reagan who tapped Norquist to head up Americans for Tax Reform in 1985. To show his gratitude and admiration, Norquist founded the Reagan Legacy Project in 1997, which aims to rename something after the 40th president in every one of the country's 3,143 counties. Norquist successfully lobbied to change the name of Washington National Airport to Reagan National, and he has waged an unsuccessful campaign to carve Reagan's face on Mount Rushmore. He's still battling to get Reagan's face on U.S. currency. Within the next 10 years, when we have the next Republican president, Reagan will be on the $10, $20, $50 bill or the dime, he said. I guarantee that he absolutely will. And now we'll turn to the best columns of the U.S., according to The Week magazine for this week. July 15th is the date of this week's edition of The Week. The first item is entitled Millionaires Who Pay No Taxes, written by Bruce Bartlett in NewYorkTimes.com. Lucky duckies, that said former Reagan administration official Bruce Bartlett is what the Wall Street Journal snidely calls low and middle income Americans who pay no federal income taxes. It would be unfair, some argue, to raise taxes on the wealthy, since 46% of tax filers do not share the burden of running the country. But the poor aren't the only lucky duckies. New data show that 78,000 households with incomes of $211,000 to $533,000 will pay not a dime in federal income taxes this year. Astonishingly, another 24,000 filers with incomes of $533,000 to $2.2 million will also pay zero. So will 3,000 filers with incomes over $2.2 million. How can this be? Our tax code is rife with tax breaks and loopholes for the wealthy. Many, for example, erase their liability by deducting past capital gains losses from this year's income. And that doesn't include illegal tax evasion, which is quite extensive among the self-employed. In the current bitter debate over raising taxes, perhaps we can agree at least on closing loopholes for wage earners at the very top. It's not socialism to ask them to pay something. The next column, the GOP's Phantom Contender, by Matt McCowiak in the NationalReview.com. Why does the media insist on treating John Huntsman like a serious presidential candidate? Asked Matt McCowiak. Beltway pundits keep touting the former Utah governor as the strongest Republican in the field, but Huntsman has no base of support and no real conservative credentials. His chances of winning the Republican nomination are virtually zero. He's not running in socially conservative Iowa and is polling last in New Hampshire, and national polls show him with just 4% of the vote. No wonder Huntsman is a moderate on climate change, favors civil unions for gay couples, and has stiff-armed the Tea Party and other conservative groups on a balanced budget pledge. The Republican base is angry at the incumbent president, and these primary voters want a candidate who shares and expresses their disgust, not a fine, gentlemanly career public servant who until recently worked as Obama's ambassador to China. In 1948, Huntsman might have made a good nominee, but we are in a different era now. And the next column is Recovering from Years of War Fever, by Andrew Basevich in the Los Angeles Times. Every few decades, the U.S. catches a bad case of foreign war fever, said Andrew Basevich. Gripped by this mania, in 1898, Americans charged off to free oppressed Cubans from Spanish tyranny. When we eventually came to our senses, having acquired an empire stretching from Puerto Rico to the Philippines, no one could quite explain what had happened or why. A feverish desire to bear any burden flared up again in the 1960s when three successive presidents committed U.S. troops to saving South Vietnam. A decade of horrific casualties followed by the fall of Saigon in 1975 temporarily inoculated the country against destructive overseas adventures. But then came 9/11, and the fever simply soared off the charts, leading to endless war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now polls show that the public is weary of war and wants our troops to come home. Republicans have joined liberal Democrats in questioning the wisdom of indefinite open-ended conflicts. Even military officials such as Defense Secretary Robert Gates warn that our armed forces are exhausted and cannot take on any more war. Is this isolationism? No, it's simply a return to sanity. And those were the best columns in the U.S., according to the Week magazine for this week. Now we'll turn to the back of the magazine and the very popular section that is entitled The Last Word. The specific subject for this week is The Secrets of Life, How to Live, Love, and Prosper, the best advice and hard-won wisdom from 2011's commencement speakers. The first one is Don't Settle for Happiness, by Toni Morrison, in her address at Rutgers University. I have often wished that Jefferson had not used that phrase, the pursuit of happiness, as the third right, although I understand in the first draft it was life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Of course, I would have been one of those properties one had the right to pursue, so I suppose happiness is an ethical improvement over a life devoted to the acquisition of land, acquisition of resources, acquisition of slaves. Still, I would rather he had written life, liberty, and the pursuit of meaningfulness, or integrity, or truth. I know that happiness has been the real, if covert, goal of your labors here. I know that it informs your choice of companions, the profession you will enter, but I urge you, please don't settle for happiness. It's not good enough. Of course you deserve it, but if that is all you have in mind, happiness, I want to suggest to you that personal success, devoid of meaningfulness, free of steady commitment to social justice, that's more than a barren life. It is a trivial one. It's looking good instead of doing good. The next item is entitled Be Fully Present, by Samantha Power, in her address at Occidental College. In whatever you do, try to be present, fully present. As Satchel Paige put it, work like you don't need the money. Love like you've never been hurt. Dance like nobody's watching. You've got to be all in. This means leaving your technology behind occasionally and listening to a friend without half of your brain preoccupied by its inner longing for the red light on the BlackBerry. I've gotten some glimpses of modern learning. In many college classes, laptops depict split screens, notes from a class, and then a range of parallel stimulants. NBA playoff statistics on ESPN.com, a flight home on Expedia, and a new flirtation on Facebook. I know how good you are at multitasking. You have developed the modern muscle set. I know of what I speak because I, too, am a culprit. You have never seen a U.S. government official and a new mother so dexterous in her ability simultaneously to BlackBerry and breastfeed, but I promise you that over time, this doesn't cut it. Something or someone loses out. No more than a surgeon can operate while tweeting can you reach your potential with one ear in and one ear out. You actually have to reacquaint yourself with concentration. We all do. We should all become, as Henry James prescribed, a person on whom nothing is lost. The next one, Choose to Stand Up by President Barack Obama, presented to the graduating class at Miami-Dade College. We've gone through periods of great economic turmoil, from an economy where most people worked on farms to one where most people worked in factories to now one fueled by information and technology. Through it all, we've persevered. We've adapted. We've prospered. Workers found their voice and the right to organize for fair wages and safe working conditions. We carried forward. When waves of Irish and Italian immigrants were derided as criminals and outcasts, when Catholics were discriminated against, or Jews had to succumb to quotas, or Muslims were blamed for society's ills, when blacks were treated as second-class citizens and marriages like my own parents were illegal in much of the country, we didn't stop. We didn't accept inequality. We fought. We overcame. We carried the dream forward. We have carried this dream forward through times when our politics seemed broken. This is not the first time where it looked like politicians were going crazy. In heated debates over our founding, some warned independence would doom America to a scene of bloody discord and desolation for ages. That was the warning about independence. One of our greatest presidents, Thomas Jefferson, was labeled an infidel and a howling atheist with fangs. Think about that. Even I haven't gotten that one yet. Lincoln, FDR, they were both vilified in their own times as tyrants, power-hungry, bent on destroying democracy. And, of course, this state has seen its fair share of tightly contested elections. And we've made it through those moments. None of it was easy. A lot of it was messy. Sometimes there was violence. Sometimes it took years, even decades, for us to find our way through. But here's the thing. We made it through. We made it through because in each of those moments, we made a choice. Rather than turn inward and wall off America from the rest of the world, we've chosen to stand up forcefully for the ideals, and the rights we believe are universal for all men and women. The next commencement address is entitled Real Love by Jonathan Franzen, presented to the class at Kenyon College. Let me toss out the idea that as our markets discover and respond to what consumers most want, our technology has become extremely adept at creating products that correspond to our fantasy ideal of an erotic relationship in which the beloved object asks for nothing and gives everything instantly and makes us all feel powerful and doesn't throw terrible scenes when it's replaced by an even sexier object and is consigned to a drawer. To speak more generally, the ultimate goal of technology, the telos of techne, is to replace a natural world that's indifferent to our wishes, a world of hurricanes and hardships and breakable hearts, a world of resistance, with a world so responsive to our wishes as to be effectively a mere extension of the self. Let me suggest finally that the world of techno-consumerism is therefore troubled by real love, and that it has no choice but to trouble love in turn. Its first line of defense is to commodify its enemy. You can all supply your own favorite, most nauseating examples of the commodification of love. Mine include the wedding industry, TV ads that feature cute young children, or the giving of automobiles as Christmas presents, and the particularly grotesque equation of diamond jewelry with everlasting devotion. The message in each case is that if you love somebody, you should buy stuff. A related phenomenon is the transformation, courtesy of Facebook, of the verb to like, from a state of mind to an action that you perform with your computer mouse, from a feeling to an assertion of consumer choice. And liking in general is commercial culture's substitute for loving. The striking thing about all consumer products, and none more so than electronic devices and applications, is that they're designed to be immensely likable. This is, in fact, the definition of a consumer product, in contrast to the product that is simply itself and whose makers aren't fixated on your liking it. I'm thinking here of jet engines, laboratory equipment, serious art, and literature. But if you consider this in human terms and you imagine a person defined by desperation to be liked, what do you see? You see a person without integrity, without a center. In more pathological cases, you see a narcissistic, a person who can't tolerate the tarnishing of his or her self-image that not being liked represents, and who therefore either withdraws from human contact or goes to extreme integrity-sacrificing lengths to be likable. If you dedicate your existence to being likable, however, and if you adopt whatever cool persona is necessary to make it happen, it suggests that you've despaired of being loved for who you really are. And if you succeed in manipulating other people into liking you, it will be hard not to feel at some level contempt for those people because they've fallen for your shtick. You may find yourself becoming depressed or alcoholic, or, if you're Donald Trump, running for president and then quitting. Consumer technology products would never do anything this unattractive because they aren't people. They are, however, great allies and enablers of narcissism. Alongside their built-in eagerness to be liked is a built-in eagerness to reflect well on us. Our lives look a lot more interesting when they're filtered through the sexy Facebook interface. We star in our own movies. We photograph ourselves incessantly. We click the mouse and a machine confirms our sense of mastery. And since our technology is really just an extension of ourselves, we don't have to have contempt for its manipulability in the way we might with other people. It's all one big endless loop. We like the mirror, and the mirror likes us. To friend a person is merely to include the person in our private hall of flattering mirrors. The simple fact of the matter is that trying to be perfectly likable is incompatible with loving relationships. Sooner or later, for example, you're going to find yourself in a hideous screaming fight, and you'll hear coming out of your mouth things that you yourself don't like at all, things that shatter your self-image as a fair, kind, cool, attractive, in-control, funny, likable person. Something realer than likability has come out in you, and suddenly you're having an actual life. And the final item here is a presentation that was made to the University of Notre Dame, and it's entitled, There Will Always Be Evil. And it was presented by Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense. A recurring theme in America for nearly a century has been a tendency to conclude after each war that the fundamental nature of man and the iron realities of nations have changed. That history, in all of its unpredictable and tragic dimensions, has come to a civilized end. That we will no longer have to confront foreign enemies with size, steel, and strength. Another tendency repeated over the last century has been for Americans repeatedly to avert their eyes in the belief that remote events elsewhere in the world need not engage this country. from the assassination of an Austrian archduke in unknown Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1914 to the rise of a group called the Taliban in Afghanistan and their alliance with an organization called Al-Qaeda in the 1990s. The lessons of history tell us we must not diminish our ability or our determination to deal with the threats and challenges on the horizon, because ultimately they will need to be confronted. If history and religion teach us anything, it is that there will always be evil in the world, people bent on aggression, oppression, satisfying their greed for wealth and power and territory, or determined to impose an ideology based on the subjugation of others and the denial of liberty to men and women. More perhaps than any other Secretary of Defense, I have been a strong advocate of soft power, of the critical importance of diplomacy and development as fundamental components of our foreign policy and national security. But make no mistake, the ultimate guarantee against the success of aggressors, dictators, and terrorists in the 21st century, as in the 20th, is hard power, the size, the strength, and the global reach of the United States military. And that was from selections from the excerpt called The Secrets of Life. They were all excerpts from various speeches made at commencement exercises this year by various national celebrities. And you're listening to The Week Magazine. Thanks for tuning in today. Let's turn to some talking points as we near the end of the program this week. Our first item from the talking points section is entitled Bachmann, Why She's Got a Real Shot. Liberals and the media had better stop laughing, said David Weigel in GQ. Michelle Bachmann, the evangelical Christian Minnesota congresswoman who recently declared her candidacy for president, has a real shot to become the Republican nominee. The Republican establishment may not like her, but she's whip smart, has made a visceral connection to the Tea Party and the social conservative base, and could easily win early primaries in Iowa and South Carolina. Bachmann, a sharp-spoken 5-foot-2 dynamo, has injected some real electricity into a lackluster Republican field, said Thomas Fitzgerald in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Conservatives love that she calls global warming a hoax, has assailed President Obama's anti-American views, and has even attacked the government's insistence that consumers buy new energy-efficient light bulbs. With Republican frontrunner Mitt Romney leading by default, Bachmann may become the anti-Mitt for those who prefer stronger medicine. Liberals aren't laughing. They're terrified, said John Cassidy in TheNewYorker.com. Bachmann is an extremist, Bible-thumping crusader against the gay lifestyle, abortion, and taxes. Her husband runs a Christian counseling center that tries to turn gays straight through therapy. Worst of all, she can't be dismissed because she's an attractive woman with a compelling story and a dynamic public speaker. And, as of last week, she's running dead even with Romney in Iowa and gaining in New Hampshire. With $13.6 million in campaign funds, Bachmann is a serious threat to the other Republican candidates, to the Democrats, and to the country. She's also a phony and a hypocrite, said Timothy Egan in the New York Times. While publicly condemning socialism and government spending, Bachmann and her family have collected $251,000 in farm subsidies over 14 years. Her husband's clinic has collected Medicaid payments of $137,000 since 2005. Yes, she does have flaws as a candidate, said Robert Costa in the National Review, but when she has to perform, Bachmann burns the midnight oil, studying policy and learning from past mistakes. That's why, in the first Republican debate, she surprised everyone by sounding so poised and well-prepared. Moderate Republicans like me still find her too extreme, said Mark McKinnon in the DailyBeast.com. But she is a rock star with the Tea Party set, and if you see how Republican audiences respond to her, you can't write her off. She's gonna be a playa, he says. The next item is the Supreme Court, business's best friend. If you run a major corporation or you want to use your great wealth to buy elections, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com, the U.S. Supreme Court has just finished off a spectacularly great term. Under Chief Justice John Roberts, a former corporate attorney, the radical conservative majority of this court spent the past year slamming the courthouse door on women, minorities, and any American seeking a level playing field. By a 5-4 vote, the court dismissed a class-action lawsuit from Walmart's underpaid female employees, said the New York Times in an editorial. It overturned an Arizona law awarding public matching funds to political candidates facing a wealthy opponent, and ruled that investors couldn't sue a mutual fund that cheated them. This consistent pattern of siding with money and power by a court whose justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas openly ally themselves with right-wing groups has badly weakened the court's reputation for being independent and partial. This court is actually not that ideological, said Jonathan Adler in the NationalReview.com. Only 20% of its rulings this term were by 5-4 votes, which is actually below average for the past decade. If it has a bias, it's in favor of free speech. Arizona's campaign finance law, for example, attempted to discourage wealthy individuals from buying political ads by holding over them the threat of publicly funded reprisal ads. The court struck down that law for precisely the same reason that it also ruled to allow the selling of violent video games to children and to let the abominable Westboro Baptist Church hold profane protests at military funerals. Free speech isn't always pretty, said the New York Post, but our nation is founded on its protection. It's a blessing to have a Supreme Court so invested in protecting America's bedrock right. It isn't free speech the court's conservative justices want to protect, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. It's paid speech. Arizona's campaign finance law didn't silence wealthy individuals who want to buy political ads. It let their less well-funded opponents respond, thereby creating more political speech. But the court's conservative bloc bristles at nearly every effort to give the less wealthy and less powerful an opportunity to prevail. What happens to democracy when the nation's highest court dedicates itself to defending the right of corporations and the rich to do as they please? That's the unfortunate experiment on which we are now embarked. And the next item, gay marriage, a turning point. Gay marriage has hit the tipping point, said John Avlon in the DailyBeast.com. With its recent landmark vote to legalize gay marriage, New York State's legislature delivered a major victory in the struggle for marriage equality across the nation. Four conservative Republican state senators provided the margin of victory, proof that public opinion has shifted dramatically in favor of recognizing same-sex marriages. As Republican State Senator James Alesi said in explaining why he'd overcome his own prejudices, if you expect equality and freedom for yourself, you have to extend it to other people. The Republican support makes this a very big deal, said Andrew Sullivan, also in the DailyBeast.com. So does the fact that New York's legalization of gay marriage isn't the sixth and largest state. It's the sixth and largest state to do so, doubles the number of Americans with the right to marry the person they love, even if they are gay. But gay rights campaigners shouldn't uncork the champagne just yet, said USA Today in an editorial. Support for gay marriage remains anything but uniform across the U.S. 30 states have written gay marriage bans into their constitutions, and so far not a single state has passed a referendum legalizing same-sex unions. In fact, in direct votes of the people, and there have been 31, marriage defined as one man, one woman has never lost, said Maggie Gallagher in the Wall Street Journal. There's a simple explanation. Most Americans continue to stubbornly believe that marriage should be defined only as the union of one man and one woman. Still, the national mood could quickly change, said the Chicago Tribune. More than one-third of Americans now live in states that permit gay marriage or civil unions. That gives the other two-thirds a good chance to look at what happens when government recognizes same-sex partnerships as a civil right. If no one's religious beliefs or practices are infringed and the sky doesn't fall, that could turn out to be the most persuasive evidence of all. Even the U.S. Supreme Court may be influenced by the changing facts on the ground, said Walter Dellinger in Slate.com. Justices won't admit it, but they can be swayed by what one legal scholar calls the normative power of the actual. The more common gay marriage becomes, the more likely it is that laws banning it will eventually be declared unconstitutional. And a couple of short items as we move toward the end of our program this week. The final bill for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq in a new Brown University study will come to between $3.7 trillion and $4.4 trillion, including nation-building efforts. The cost of providing medical care, services, and long-term benefits to veterans, and interest on what the U.S. borrowed to fund the wars. Despite the soft economy, high employment, and stagnant wages are, for most workers, top executives got huge raises last year. The average paycheck for top executives at 200 big companies in 2010 was $10.8 million, a 23% gain from 2009. Over the last three decades, America's went from eating an average of 3.8 meals and snacks a day to 4.9. The average American now consumes about 2,375 calories per day, about 32% more than in the 1970s. And about $17 billion in unemployment insurance benefits paid out over the past year, 11.6% of the total, was obtained through fraud, the U.S. Labor Department says. People are cheating by the government, mainly by continuing to cash checks after they find a job, or by claiming benefits for which they are not eligible. And now let's look at our poll watch for this week. 39% of Americans say the U.S. economy is in permanent decline, up from 28% in October. 57% say the economy will eventually recover, which is down from 68% in October. And 53% of Americans say the U.S. is one of the greatest countries in the world, along with some others. 38% say the U.S. stands alone above all others as the greatest country. And 8% of Americans say that there are other countries that are better. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it today. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long, until next time.